Greetings, podcast listeners, and welcome to the June edition of the Colorado Review podcast. My name's Daniel Schoening.
And I'm Evan Senny.
And our episode today is devoted to a long look at editions of Colorado Review past.
It includes a couple pieces from a seemingly one-time Flash issue called Trying Fiction from 2001.
Also included, as this is more than anything a practice that allows Daniel to look back at past poets he admires and esteems and is deeply jealous of in previous editions of Colorado Review, we have huge names from the field of poetry that I hope everyone else will enjoy as much as I do.
From the Flash issue, we'll have pieces by Melanie Ray Tone and Lon Otto.
And in poetry, across several editions and decades, we'll have pieces by David St. John, C.D. Wright, Gene Valentine, and Charles Wright. So stay with us.
We're going to start with a piece from the Flash issue by Melanie Ray Tone, who has received many accolades, including a fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation and a Whiting's Award. Her piece is called Blind Fish. My father says nobody whose word can be trusted has pulled a sturgeon from this lake since 1927, but divers searching for drowned children and drowned mothers swear they've seen fish bigger than themselves hiding in the lake's deepest trenches. A freshwater sturgeon can grow 12 feet long. One old fish with barbells that look like whiskers might live 100 years if no hungry human hooks or spears her. They resist change. Their Jurassic ancestors would find them sweetly familiar, still recognizable, though there are 150 million years between them. They resemble sharks or mermaids or monsters. Their snouts are flat, their skulls bony. Swim bladders in their guts allow them to breathe air for several hours, long enough to roll in the shallows and spawn over rocks, long enough to flop on the beach while they wait for the fisherman with a club to kill them. In courtship, they tumble and leap near the bottom, or so we are told. What human has ever seen this? They are loved for their delicate flesh and even more loved for their delicate caviar. You can kill the female and eat all of her, or you can catch her to strip the eggs, and this is said to be more merciful. They are bottom feeders, but not scavengers. This distinction is important. With their barbells, they search the sediment for living prey, insect larvae, snails, worms, crayfish. They are not vicious. Big as they are, they won't attack you. Hours after it is caught, a half-frozen 15-inch pike can bite hard enough to draw blood as you try to gut it. But a sturgeon will look at you with its sad eyes as if to say, I'm older than your grandmother. What are you doing? They are not blind, after all. They see you. When they surface to feed in the shoals, their vision miraculously returns to them. Amazed, they understand that loss of sense is a choice of environment, a fact in the lake's treacherous canyons, but not, in the end, irreversible. Seeing you, they are not grateful for sight. They think, we did not miss much. Don't be deceived by the scales. A sturgeon is soft inside and delicious. Some claim there are monsters in this lake. They have pictures to prove it. But the pictures are always grainy, out of focus, so the monster might be a log tossed by a wave, a trick of light, a sturgeon breaching. The monster might be your own memory, wild horses, your mother who can breathe air but doesn't want to, who goes down instead, who seeks the deepest trench, the one unmeasured, carved by the glacier that dug this lake, then melted to fill it. If you fall in the water, you're safe where it's white. That's the foam, near the surface. Where it's green, you have hope. Swim toward the light. Keep your faith. Imagine all the people on shore who still love you. If it's black and you're blind, you can lose your direction, make mistakes, or grow weary. That far down, the weight of water is oppressive, which is why, I suppose, the sturgeon's scales are hard as enamel, why its body is flat and has five bony ridges, why it rises out of the lake to swim miles upstream where it spawns in a dangerous river.
a stunning piece. I'm taken especially with that through line that's set up so early about the fish being female, the fish being a figure of motherhood, that begins just kind of innocuously in the form of pronouns and then moves into the harvesting of eggs, and then very much in the vein of Vardaman from As I Lay Dying, my mother is a fish, that the mother can breathe air but chooses not to. How stunning.
Yeah, and it does a move I've seen before in Flash where it sort of sets a tone, in this case, a combination of a researched thing and some insight about the life that research describes. Hmm. What it's really setting us up for is a break from that right near the end when there's speculation about what kind of monster there can be.
Mm-hmm.
And we get an insight into the life of the speaker and the concerns of the speaker and what perhaps drew them to this fish or this line of thinking in the first place.
And among so many through lines that feel so rich, in addition to those that are operating at the surface, there's just so many adjacent pools of meaning from which the reader can draw. Thinking about the title's interaction, blind fish interacting with the notion that the fish being so much older than in their singular form, but also being inheritors of, persisting through time over the course of generations, so much longer than humankind. When they look at humans, they don't see much. They're not glad to be able to see you. The way that reflects on the crisis of the speaker, of the writer, of the human condition, and then what that means to be seen or unseen, to be misseen as a monster, as a log. All of that is so rich and offers so much in such a compact space. And to that point, I think this is indicative of the form of Flash generally, where it, I think, is right on the cusp of operating in the scheme of a prose poem, in that the title offers a vital entryway into the piece generally, and absent that title, an element is utterly missing. That part of the economy of language operating in Flash demands that every morsel pulls its weight.
Hmm. It's interesting that it takes brief forays into subsections of the topic, like we go from the sturgeon very briefly to the pike, mm-hmm. as a sort of counterweight, the fish that even half dead will bite you. And the sturgeon is set up as literally weightier than that, mm-hmm. than a pike, but also somehow more wise.
Yeah. And within that wisdom and the difference in age and longevity, that very opening kind of sets us on a path that's intentionally subverted. My father says, which sets up the speaker as youthful, catering to a received knowledge of an object rather than an experience. And so that focus of the father that quickly falls away and recrystallizes around the concern of the mother, I think likewise is such a calculated control over the expectations of the reader, so that we are hit in full with the revelations that come later in the piece. To begin in poetry, this is David St. John's Aspects of Solange. 1. Where are the skies, ambassadors, tonight? Weeping, no doubt. Yes, I have no doubt. They are most certainly weeping by the smoky, wine-colored fire. Now the long, black rake of the rain has arrived. 2. So she prays the pale violet riders passing over the broken heath. She prays the passage of black islands rising along her body and beyond the ravel of lips. She prays the opulent spray of the waves and the smoky blush of recognition as that satin of evening light wrapped her naked shoulders. She prays her own fine scent and its ghostliness, weaving together the lesions of night. 3. The old villa reflected the silver light of ancient stones along every stairway, those endless ascents and pitches of terrible precipice where below her father's vineyards stretched for miles to the mountains. And out of the silence of the moment, Solange's sister stepped from a doorway, holding her coat in one hand, saying abruptly, "Don't you think it's time we are going?" 4. The days grew older, but quietly. Against the driver's side window of the car, red and gold maple leaves pressed like the hands of supplicants, as the white stumps of fence posts picked off the miles towards a horizon sharp and scoured as a burnished bowl, sunlit and brittle, almost aflame. 5. The fountain in the hospital courtyard touched the pursed lips of the wind. The fallen palm fronds slowly littered the cobbled stones of the path, leading along the tall white and pulsing walls. No more interior fortunes at work. This evening, as she steps a bit closer to the mirror of the room's ancient vanity, her face skeletal in the radium moon of the clock. And she fans brush strokes of rouge along each cheekbone, as the quiet incline of her breath disperses like a mist, the cautionary light gathering slowly towards her eclipse. 6. How hard, then, to be home. Even the gnarled sheep-like shrubs fell to their knees along the heath, beneath the sweep of the butterscotch wind. The scent of damp wool hung in the air, with the scent of the cedar slats he'd thrown onto the fire the night before, just as she'd called to him from the bed, piled high with animal skins and ancient blankets, her arms so thin and bare chiming, with silver bracelets collapsing together as she lifted her hands to his face, and the musk seeping in at the dark edges of the window unrolled like a calendar of those future nights. He would awaken simply naked and alone in the absent shine of her body. 7. And so she left them all behind, weeping, no doubt. Yes, I have no doubt. They were most certainly weeping as the carver's chisel scored the stone, and then the sky rang bright as bone. As ever at Colorado Review and the Center for Literary Publishing, we have heaps and heaps going on in addition to this lovely podcast. Brandon Krieg's stunning collection entitled Magnifier was selected by final judge Kazem Ali as winner of the 2019 Colorado Prize for Poetry. You can get your own copy this November at our website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. While you're there, you can also pick up a copy of our summer edition of Colorado Review, forthcoming in July. For those hoping to have their own work featured in Colorado Review, although we are not accepting fiction or poetry submissions until August, we are accepting creative nonfiction submissions year-round. This next piece is from the wonderful C.D. Wright, entitled The Shepherd of Resumed Desire. One steps forward under a sifter of light, holding a globe in ungloved hands. We share the experience of dying in snow. Pages turn on illuminated fragments. We become aware of the extremes, joy and revenge, the fierce confusion therein. One form senses another. When there is pressure from all sides, and wasn't the light seminal tilting toward us, nay, labial, we knew from the start the center was within us. This blizzard, this conversation could go on for years. Should you go? Should you stay? No shoulds about it, no matter why the hole was made. The task is not yours to fill it. Why standest thou so near to the brink? How old were you when you first lay down before the god of love? What was the objective? A staff against the wolf of reality. Nay, to get warm, only to get warm. Would you be let down again if I said it were not the one true God, but only a candle of the same? Where were we in the middle of a phrase? We froze, we fell, we went to a gilded hell. I only have escaped to tell you, though I have come to be lost. I do not ask you to lose your own self in my triangle, only to keep watch, yea, to keep watch over the shaping of the sky, snow orbiting all. Abide, abide. Next is a poem by Jean Valentine entitled 11th Brother. One arm still a swan's wing. The worst had happened before. Love, before I knew it was mine, turned into a swan and flew across the rough water. Outsider, seed word, until I die, I will be open to you as an egg, speechless red. This final poem from Charles Wright is entitled Still Life with Stick and Word. April is over, May moon. How many more for my regard? Hundreds? A handful? Better not trouble the dark water due north of north. Better to concentrate on something close, something small. This stick, for instance, this word. Next week, back in the same chair, and there's the stick, right where I dropped it, deep in the grass. Maple, most likely. Fuzz barked and twice broken, spore pocked with white spots, star charts to ford the river of heaven, warm wood, warm wind from the clouds. Inside now, the word is white. It covers my tongue like paint. I say it and light forms. Bottles arise, emptiness opens its corridors into the entrances and endless things that form bears. White, great eviscerator. Out into absence, night chair. Rose constellations rise up from the shed and sad trees, white yips in the dog park that mirror the overburn. A slide of house light escapes through the kitchen window. How unlike it is. How like. Having never read that final poem before, I think of often I'm permitted to return to a meadow and poems like that that end up being tent poles for the rest of us to understand concepts of language and iconography and the like and what it is we're doing as makers, as poets. And this one sings so clearly to that effect, and I'm amazed to have never read it before.
I loved the moment in the middle sonically where we went from the, I think, spores on the stick to the star charts.
Mm-hmm. And it, to your point, it is so sonically impactful. It orients itself as much on the level of syntax and logic as it does on the music and the image of the work, to use that those archetypes of poetry. Those moments like, the word is white. It covers my tongue like paint. And then later, white, great eviscerator. What a concept. White, great eviscerator. One can feel those snow clouds moving in. One can feel white as absence, as lack. And that invocative opening line of April is over, May moon. Even as we've yet to arrive at that central concept of white, it's present. It's present in everything.
The second piece that I'll read from the Flash issue is by Lon Otto, and it's called The Old Truth in Costa Rica. I will tell you a true story. One time, a perezoso, what you call a sloth, was caught on the forest floor. He had come down from the treetops to do his weekly business and was in the process of burying it when a jaguar came along and took advantage of the situation and ate him. When the other perezosos learned of this calamity, alas, all too common, they came together to speak well of the dead one and to see if anything could be done about the danger, which each of them faced once a week, the elders somewhat less frequently. Half awake, one of the mourners felt a tear swelling out of his eye and moved to brush it away, though by the time his claw reached his face, the tear had long since fallen. So he delicately scratched his nose and said to the others, "Perhaps we should abandon this practice that brings so many of us to grief." After considering the suggestion for some time, another Perezoso said, "But if we do not descend to the forest floor to do our business where we can bury it, our enemy, the jaguar, will smell it and know we are here." The others pondered this and at length agreed that it was so, remembering that that was the explanation for the custom. But the one who had spoken first observed, "Our neighbors, the monkeys, let fly from the highest treetop, and they seem none the worse for it. If the jaguar cannot reach us, what does it matter that he knows we are here?" "We are not monkeys," the second speaker declared, and all of them, even he who had spoken first, slowly nodded their heads. "We have always followed this practice," a third said. "To do otherwise would not be typical of us." The second one agreed, saying again, "We are not monkeys." It was approaching night, the conversation having taken up the better part of a day. Out of the fragile light, a fourth Perezoso spoke, the oldest and wisest of them, who had to descend to the forest floor on business no more than once every 2 or 3 weeks, but then required many hours to accomplish what was necessary. He said, "The truth is this. Dropped casually from the safety of our beloved branches, our shit would be merely shit. Hard and shapely as our patient nature makes it, it is still shit. But when we plant it in the ground where the jaguar walks, it becomes precious as jewels." Dark fell. Somebody asked, "Why? Why does it?" But he got no answer. Hours later, when all of them had drifted from half awake to half asleep, the old one spoke again, so softly nobody understood him. It sounded more like a snore. He said, "It just does. It just does."
I was listening to an episode of On Being, that wonderful podcast, earlier this week, and Gregory Orr was talking about Robert Hayden's Those Winter Sundays, and the final lines of it are, what did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? And he dwelled on and explained that power of that repeated phrase, "What did I know? What did I know?" as opposed to "one." And that within that doubling, there's a consciousness that springs into life. And I think the doubling of that final phrase in this wonderful piece likewise reflects back on that consciousness.
I also think that it avoids a pitfall sometimes of flash things, and especially of trying to operate from the viewpoint of an animal, where we understand that it's probably a metaphor for a thing, and we're suspicious that it's going to be some neatly tied thing. Mm-hmm. And I think what was so satisfying about the ending and allows it to be an invitation to a much deeper and more powerful meaning is that there is no good answer. Mm-hmm. The oldest and wisest one can only say it just does.
Yeah, and that our crisis is always just kind of lagging. We are lagging behind the ability, the moment, the proper means to mend our crisis as it happens, that it's always retroactive. The tear's already fallen before we can brush it from our cheek and so on.
Hmm.
Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you all for joining us in looking back at these wonderful pieces of writing. As stunning, as impressive, as heartening reading these major names of the past is, it also reflects on the present literary landscape so beautifully. Those names that are present in Collaborative Review now, even those that you might not be intimately familiar with, will no doubt be worthy of these sorts of retrospective glances. And so it's certainly worth getting in, understanding them, knowing them, being fans before they're cool. So please do go to our website, track down a copy of Colorado Review, keep up to date with those new writers that are producing now that will eventually be in these kinds of places.
As ever, thanks to Stephanie Geschwind, editor-in-chief at Colorado Review, whose work makes all of this possible, and thank you to Arnie Geschwind, who composed the wonderful music that you heard on this podcast.
I'm Daniel Schoening.
And I'm Evan Senny.
Thank you again for joining us for our June podcast. We hope to have you back here again in July.